Welcome to The Point. I'm Dan Tridle in for Mindy Todd. It's our monthly book show, and today, books on nature. Fitting topic for the Cape and Islands. Over the years, we've been the setting for many writers and artists. Today in studio, Gabrielle Faria-Kakalnis from Sturgis Library in Barnstable. Good morning.
Good morning, Dan.
And Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich. Hello.
Good morning, Dan.
Ray, books on nature. This was your idea. What prompted the topic?
Yes. Well, I think a couple months ago when we did our last show on technology, the morning of the show, I was sitting out on the deck drinking coffee and listening to the birds chirp and looking out at the beautiful scenery, and I was just like, we need to do nature. I want to read about nature.
A little balance.
Yeah, yeah.
And both of you have brought a stack of books today. Ray, what's at the top of your list?
Yes. So I'm from Sandwich, and Titcomb's Bookshop is in Sandwich, and the Greenbrier Nature Center and Thornton Burgess Museum is in Sandwich. And this year, we're celebrating the 150th birthday of Thornton W. Burgess. And if you don't know who Thornton W. Burgess was, he was a naturalist and a conservationist, as well as a children's author. And he actually wrote over 170 children's books and about 15,000 stories for his daily newspaper column that ran between 1912 and 1960, I think it was. And he really inspired a love of nature and children through his books. And you might know Old Mother West Wind and The Adventures of Jimmy Skunk and Peter Cottontail, Reddy Fox. He had dozens of animal characters that he would tell stories about, and the writing is just so nostalgic and wholesome, and it really just sparks joy and a love of nature.
By the way, we will have a list of all the books we talk about on today's show later on today at our website, capeandislands.org. And if you have books on nature that you'd like to contribute, that you'd like to talk about, that you think we should talk about, give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Gabrielle, what do you have?
So my first book reminds me of, Ray, your inspiration for this topic, because this is the author's observations of her backyard. And one of the things we love about nature is the way it can restore balance to our lives. Like you said, we're so inundated with technology and news, and things can feel overwhelming and anxiety-ridden. So one good way to, this author argues that it's communing with nature is not a way to bury your head in the sand and escape those problems, but it's a way to restore a little bit of balance to your life. By immersing herself in the natural world, she maintains that she's able to cope with the toxic politics of today's world. But that's really not what it's about. It's really more about the nature observations that she makes and living in the rhythm of nature. So this is called The Comfort of Crows, excuse me, A Backyard Year by Margaret Renkel. This came out in October of last year. Margaret Renkel is an essayist and contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. She has written three books, including the 2019 essay collection, Late Migrations, A Natural History of Love and Loss. In The Comfort of Crows, A Backyard Year, Renkel presents a literary devotional. So, like a devotional, it's separated into 52 individual chapters that range in length from about 1 to 5 pages each. So these are quick little chapters that you can dip into. You can read it cover to cover, or you can just take it week by week. Each chapter follows the creatures and plants in Renkel's Nashville backyard and the nearby trails and local parks through the changing of the seasons. So the book distills observations taken over several years into separate chapters that correspond with each week in a single year. So it starts off at the beginning of the year, right at New Year's in winter, and it continues for a full year. And there's a story, I guess, that the first bird you see in the new year will indicate how your year is going to go. So the first bird that she sees is a crow, and she likes that it's a crow because crows are extremely intelligent, they're quirky, and so that kind of animates the theme of the whole book is the crow. So let's see. Throughout the book, she reminds readers of humanity's symbiotic relationship with nature and encourages us to think about the ways that we interact with the flora and fauna around us. It includes snapshots of events taking place during this season of her life, too. So it brings in personal anecdotes and stories about her family. For example, stories about her grown sons who were forced back home during the pandemic and who prepare to fly the nest once more. So also in this book, Margaret Renkel's brother, Billy Renkel, is an extremely talented artist. So there are 52 color collages accompanying each chapter. So it's just a delight to view the art and to read about the nature in conjunction. So according to Billy Renkel, the collages braid together three threads that also run through the manuscript: the natural world as a source of curiosity when carefully examined with clear eyes, as a source of astonishment and devotion, and as a model for understanding ourselves in relation to each other and the world.
And that's The Comfort of Crows?
Yes.
Margaret Renkel?
Yes.
This is The Point on CAI. We're talking about books on nature. Ray, what do you have?
My next one is called A Window into the Ocean Twilight Zone, 24 Days of Science at Sea. It's by Michelle Cusolito. And it's for ages about 8 to 12. And what I really like about this book is she really gets into the technology aspect of the research trip. She goes on a trip with scientists from Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, as well as international researchers. And their goal is to study the twilight zone at the bottom of the ocean. And there's so much that we don't know about the twilight zone, so it's really important that people are researching this right now. So it's really great that she's inspiring an interest of this topic in young people. We're learning that the twilight zone is really important for the planet. For example, it regulates the Earth's climate by moving carbon from the surface of the ocean to the bottom. And we are trying to learn more about processes like this that the twilight zone is responsible for, and more about what animals are down there and possible fishing potential of it's possible that a lot of life down there could sustain us. And so it's really important work that these researchers are doing. And Michelle has a great way of bringing this to children and young readers. And I'm going to read a quote from Peter Domenical, who is the president and director of HUI. And he says, "Michelle Cusolito captures the essence of high seas research in A Window into the Ocean Twilight Zone. She skillfully guides the reader through what it's like to be a scientist at sea, the anticipation of departure, the challenges of heavy weather, and the thrill of discovery in one of the ocean's most remote and mysterious regions. In the process, she underscores the urgency behind advancing knowledge of Earth's last frontier, the ocean." And I would say this book is perfect for any young person who is interested in marine science and possibly wants to become a biologist one day.
Oh, excellent. Again, that's the book is
A Window into the Ocean Twilight Zone by Michelle Cusolito.
Excellent. Gabrielle.
So this time I asked my coworkers each for a recommendation about their picks so that we could get a variety of perspectives. And two of my coworkers actually separately came to me with books by Rachel Carson, who I didn't know about before this, but I did a little bit of digging and I learned that she's truly a fascinating figure. She was a marine biologist and nature writer, considered the mother of the modern environmental movement. She was born in 1907 on a farm in Pennsylvania and was the youngest of three children. She developed an early love of nature from her mother and became a published writer for a children's magazine by age 10. She attended the Pennsylvania College for Women, graduating magna cum laude in 1929. And then, local connection, she studied for a time at HUI, and then at Johns Hopkins University, where she received a master's degree in zoology in 1932. And you have to think of this era, women going on and becoming educated and getting, higher degrees. So she went on to work for the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries and was eventually promoted to editor-in-chief of all publications for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Meanwhile, she wrote several popular books about aquatic life and won a National Book Award, a National Science Writing Prize, and a Guggenheim Grant. So amid all this success, she received a letter from a friend in Duxbury, Massachusetts, about the loss of local bird life after DDT spraying inspired. So this letter that she received was from a friend who was saying, they sprayed this chemical and now all of the birds are dying. I believe the friend had a bird sanctuary and really observed a massive loss of life. So she wrote to her friend, Rachel Carson, and Rachel Carson decided to write my coworker Kathy's pick, which is Silent Spring.
Silent Spring, yes, indeed. Yes. It's groundbreaking.
Groundbreaking. Yes. I mean, it sounds like it was very famous and instrumental in bringing about the way people think about environmental protection. But it was something I didn't know about. So this 1962 book catalyzed the global environmental movement by outlining the dangers of chemical pesticides. The book primarily focuses on pesticides' effects on ecosystems, but four chapters detail their impact on human health, including as a cause of cancer. She accused the chemical industry of spreading misinformation and public officials of accepting industry claims uncritically. The book does not suggest that pesticides should never be used, but rather advocates for the responsible and carefully managed use of pesticides with an awareness of the chemicals' impact on ecosystems and human health. The book release created a firestorm of criticism from chemical companies and some inside government who tried to discredit her. One former Secretary of Agriculture even went so far as to ask in a letter to former President Eisenhower why a spinster with no children was so concerned about genetics and concluded that she was probably a communist.
Okay.
The detractors were not successful, though, and both the public and scientific community came to understand that this work revealed important truths about the dangers of indiscriminate use of untested and unregulated pesticides. And it led to a nationwide ban on DDT and other pesticides and sparked an environmental movement that ultimately led to the creation of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Indeed. And Rachel Carson is a revered figure among many on the Cape. In fact, there is a statue of Rachel Carson gazing out at the water just down the street from us here.
Oh my gosh, I've seen that statue so many times and I didn't place it. I do want to continue with my coworker Lisa's pick, which is also Rachel Carson.
Sure.
If there's time.
Yes.
My coworker Lisa loves The Sense of Wonder, a celebration of nature for parents and children, written in 1955. So in 1955, Rachel Carson began work on an essay that she would come to consider one of her life's most important projects. Her grandnephew, Roger Christie, had visited Carson that summer at her cottage in Maine, and together they had wandered the surrounding woods and tide pools. Teaching Roger about the natural wonders around them, Carson began to see them anew herself and wanted to relate the same magical feelings to others. So Lisa says, I chose this book because people of all ages and stages of life need to be gently reminded to take time in their life, with or without children, to appreciate and feel the beauty of nature with a sense of wonder and newness. So she continues, I read this book for the first time when my daughter was a little girl, and I still think of the sections from the book where Rachel Carson wrote the following when she was looking up at the night sky on a summer evening. So this is a quote from the book. With a friend, I went out on a flat headland that is almost a tiny island, being all but surrounded by waters of the bay. There the horizons are remote in distant rims on the edge of space. We lay and looked up at the sky and the millions of stars that blazed in the darkness. The night was so still that we could hear the buoy on the ledges out beyond the mouth of the bay. Once or twice, a word spoken by someone on the far shore was carried across the clear air. A few lights burned in cottages. Otherwise, there was no reminder of other human life. My companion and I were alone with the stars. I have never seen them more beautiful. The misty river of the Milky Way flowing across the sky, the patterns of the constellations standing out bright and clear, a blazing planet low on the horizon. Once or twice, a meteor burned its way into the Earth's atmosphere. It occurred to me that if this were a sight that could be seen only once in a century, or even once in a human generation, this little headland would be thronged with spectators. But it can be seen many scores of nights in any year, and so the lights burned in the cottages, and the inhabitants probably gave not a thought to the beauty overhead. And because they could see it almost any night, perhaps they will never see it.
And that's The Sense of Wonder by Rachel Carson.
Yes. Okay.
We are talking about books on nature, The Point at CapeEndIslands.org. If you would like to contribute a book or some thoughts, we'll talk more about books on nature after this break. You are listening to The Point on CAI. It's our monthly book show. We're talking about books on nature. Our guests today in the studio, Gabrielle Faria-Kakalnis from Sturgis Library in Barnstable and Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich, 866-999-4626, or The Point at CapeEndIslands.org if you have books that you'd like to contribute. I'd like to mention a couple of books that are must, the top of the list for any nature books. Henry Beston's The Outermost House. A lot of folks familiar with that. Beston's Outermost House chronicles a year that he spent in the dunes in Orleans that was published in the 1920s. And Henry David Thoreau's Cape Cod, based on several trips that he made to the Cape, originally published in 1865. As a series of articles, Thoreau's Cape Cod depicts the natural beauty of the Cape and the nature that surrounds it. Ray, what do you have?
My next pick is The Light Eaters by Zoe Schlanger. I recently read Peter Wohlleben's The Hidden Life of Trees, which was written about 10 years ago.
Oh, and yes. Excellent.
Yes. Really, really good. But it left me wanting more because there's so much more to discover about plant life. And this book definitely satisfies, or well, begins to satisfy someone looking for more information about plants. It just came out recently, and it has groundbreaking discoveries about plant life. And I'm going to read a review by my colleague Matthew. And he says, this is an amazing paradigm-shifting book. Zoe Schlanger takes us to the cutting edge of botanical research, laying out a thorough, nuanced argument for the reframing of humankind's relationship to plants. Her writing is passionate and clear, consistently captivating and enjoyable to read. I was so impressed by her ability to describe complicated ideas, not only making them accessible to laypeople, but also imbuing them with beauty and wonder. An essential read for fans of Entangled Life and The Hidden Life of Trees. P.S. I want to follow the Bokila research now. And what Matthew is referring to there is a vine called the Bokila trifoliate trifoliolata, which is a plant that can mimic exactly the leaf shape, color, size, vein pattern, texture, etc. of whatever plant it's growing next to. And it doesn't even have to be touching the plant to mimic it. It's really amazing how it has evolved to learn to do this. And it's just, that's just one example of the creativity and ingenuity of plants. And one of the things that Schlanger talks about in the book is the intelligence of plants and how they're not necessarily mimicking human intelligence, but more they've sort of formed a system of intelligence of their own that is parallel to ours, which is a really interesting concept. For example, human intelligence involves centralized processing, so the brain, but plant intelligence is decentralized and operates through a network of responses and interactions rather than conscious deliberation. And I found that super, super interesting. There's more to talk about, but...
And that's The Light Eaters?
Yes, The Light Eaters by Zoe Schlanger.
I love that title. It's, if it weren't a nature book that you didn't have it here, it would be like a great title for like a bad science fiction
book. Yeah, totally. Yes.
Gabrielle, what do you have?
So my next pick is a children's book. It was recommended by our youth services librarian, Christy, who actually designed her summer reading program, our summer reading program, around nature's wonders. So our summer reading is really fun. The kids can, they come in, they sign up, and for each different genre they read, they get a corresponding button pin with a neat little wonder of nature on it. So for instance, if you read a book of poetry, you get a button pin with the weaver bird on it. A biography, you get a button pin with a little ghost plant.
Oh, that's cute.
Yes. And in the packet that describes the program, she's included interesting facts about the weaver bird, the ghost plant. So children are learning about nature, decorating their backpacks, and doing their summer reading. And they can also be entered into a raffle where they will win a gift certificate to Take Homes.
Oh, so, excellent. Okay.
It's all coming full circle here. Speaking of full circle, her book recommendation was called The Wheel of the Year. As you can see, the cover of this book, there is a wheel on it that is separated into 8 sections, and each section corresponds with a different time of the year and seasonal changes. So Christy says, this is a beautifully illustrated book that serves as a guide to ancient nature-based holidays and customs. Young readers and adults too can learn about old and new ways of honoring the seasons. This book encourages us to slow down and honor nature. I love it. So this book, I like how Christy said, and adults too, because as adults, there is so much information we can learn from children's books, picture books, because often children's book authors have taken difficult to understand information and put it in a really easy to understand way in a lot of beautifully illustrated pictures. So I'm just opening the book to give you guys a view of it. Of course, the listeners can't see it, but
that's a gorgeous looking
gorgeous
book.
Wow. Illustrations throughout. So I'm just opening the page to the section of the wheel that we're currently in, which is, I believe, pronounced Lunasa.
Yes, and Lunasa. It's a festival, a Gaelic festival, marking the beginning of the harvest season. Today is Lunasa.
That's right.
Actually, sundown tonight.
So, yes, and that is included in this chapter of the book, but there's also the ancient Greek celebration from this time of year, Celtic and Anglo-Saxon, also Caribbean celebrations and traditions. And in addition to the different celebrations, it gives you activities that kind of get you in the spirit of that time of year. So, for instance, here's one. It's a scavenger hunt for night walking, and it gives you things to look for. Look for the moon, what phase is it in? And then it refers you to another page where it teaches you about the phases of the moon. It tells you to look for a firefly, a bat, a moth, different things that are part of this time. But there is one thing I wanted to read. It talks about the dog days of summer, and it sort of gives you the origin of what that means. It says, the phrase the dog days of summer conjures an image of a dog lying in the shade, panting with its tongue hanging out, too hot to move. It used to be said that dogs went mad in the hottest days of summer. But the dog days don't refer to overheated pups. They're named after Sirius, also known as the dog star, which rises around this time of year. Sirius, the brightest star in the night sky, is the nose of the Canis Major, big dog constellation. Historically, when Sirius rose high in the sky, the Greeks knew the hot, dry season was upon them. Discomfort is often associated with the rise of the dog days, though, of course, some people thrive in warm weather.
Excellent.
Yes.
And the book is, once again?
The book is The Wheel of the Year by Fiona Cook and Jessica Rue.
Okay, excellent. Okay. If you have a book that you'd like to recommend, 866-999-4626, or send us an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Ray, what do you have?
Well, thank you for that dog days fact, Gabrielle. I've always been curious about that, so yes. Happy to learn about
that. It's good
to know. And speaking of children's books that are beneficial to both children and adults, my next pick is Song of the Birds, A Guide to North American Bird Calls and Songs by Isabel Otter. And I love this. It's a board book. It's pretty short, you know, good, really good for young children, but it's also really great for adults too, because it has 24 different bird calls in it. And I'm going to play one for you. And so that it's really helpful for if you want to learn, you know, the different bird calls to identify birds around here.
So, bring that right up to the microphone there.
Yeah. So this is my favorite one. Well, let me see if it's, got to make sure it's turned on. Okay, it's my favorite. And the quality of the sound in this book is really, really good, because, like, sometimes you'll have sound books that are just, the sound is, like, so grating. But this one is really nice. It's crystal clear,
It's a nice looking book.
Variety is great. Yeah, it goes through 7 different North American habitats and several birds within them, and gives little facts about the birds, and it starts in the morning and then it ends in the evening. So there's a little, it kind of walks you through all the different habitats, and really, really well done.
That's excellent. What's the book once again?
Song of the Birds by Isabel Otter.
And how does she spell her last name?
Otter, just like the animal.
Okay. Gabrielle, what do you have?
So my next pick is from our library director, Lucy Loomis. She chose a book of fiction called The Vaster Wilds by Lauren Groff. This came out in September of last year. So Lucy says, this is a novel set in Jamestown beginning around 1609 during a period known to historians as the Starving Time, because over 80% of the colonists died of disease and famine. The main character, an unnamed young girl who is a servant for a prosperous family, escapes from Jamestown and sets off into the wilderness to find safety from the numerous dangers that surround her. Though she is pursued by threatening men, including a soldier, a priest, a native, in the wilderness challenges her at every turn, it is the wilderness and nature and her own cunning intelligence that propels her on her journey. This is a raw, poetic, short novel that reminds us that we are just an infinitesimal part of the natural world. I also read this novel, and I have to say the descriptions of the forest and nature are so vivid. It really puts the reader into the wilderness with this main character as she struggles to survive. And it makes you think about how much we take for granted, how easy our lives are, and how if we had to rely on just ourselves and the natural world, it would be an all-consuming endeavor just to survive. I have a quote from the book that exemplifies the language. So There was only wind drawing itself endlessly over the dark crowns of the pines, over the face of the water, over the mountains' icy peaks, over the great wide golden stretches of the teeming land. The wind passed, even as it is passing now, over all the people who find themselves so dulled by the concerns of their own bodies and their own hungers that they cannot stop for a moment to feel its goodness as it brushes against them, and feel it now, so soft, so eternal, this wind against your good and living skin. So the book is just filled with
That's marvelous.
Writing like
yeah.
that. Yeah.
What's the book called again?
It's called The Vaster Wilds by Lauren Groff.
Lauren Groff. So this is, I would like to throw in a title that is sort of related in a way. It's by Bill McKibben, a name that a lot of people might recognize. He's a writer who writes a lot about climate change, writes a lot about nature. He's written fiction and nonfiction, and he wrote a book back in 1992 that's still relevant today. It's called The Age of Missing Information, and essentially he compares, and this is pre-internet, but he compares a day's worth of cable TV to meditating in nature and thinking about the natural world, and asks, what have we lost okay, we know the temperature in Brisbane, Australia, but what have we, so we know that, but right. what have we lost in the meantime, all this knowledge?
Right, to our own local experience of the natural world.
Or just what have we lost as far as knowledge of the natural world, that we don't know things anymore that people used to.
Yes.
So, yeah. Again, that's The Age of Missing Information by Bill McKibben. 866-999-4626 is the number, or thepoint@capeandislands.org. We will talk more about books on nature after this break. You are listening to The Point on CAI. Today is the monthly book show. We're talking about books on nature with Gabrielle Ferrillo-Caconis from Sturgis Library and Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Books. If you have a book you'd like to contribute, 866-999-4626 or thepoint@capeandislands.org. Ray, what do you have?
The next one is The New England Gardener's Year, a month-by-month guide for northeastern states by Reese Manley and Marjorie Peronto. And this book is jam-packed with information about gardening in New England. It's a month-by-month guide from March through October that has suggested dates for planting and tending adjusted for each zone, augmented by advice on topics like soil testing, composting, pruning, landscape design, how to provide a season-long source of pollen and nectar for beneficial insects. It just has so much in it. There are charts and tables to help you diagnose and treat different problems that are happening with your plants or garden, and determine when to plant or perform certain maintenance. And a lot of the information is just, it's succinct and simple, but also very specific and detailed. Yeah. And I really like the author's approach. In their view, our plots of land that we live on are really extensions of the surrounding natural world rather than our yards or our gardens. And as gardeners, we are caretakers of that world. And they advocate for gardening in tune with nature, avoiding pesticides, chemical fertilizers, and invasive plants, and creating a garden that really enhances local biodiversity and native plants.
Mm. That's great. What's the book again?
The New England Gardener's Year.
Oh, excellent title. Very fitting.
Yes.
Okay. Gabrielle, what do you have?
So my next pick comes from my coworker, Jack, who chose The Book of Eels, Our Enduring Fascination with the Most Mysterious Creature in the Natural World by Patrick Svensson. So this book was published in 2020 and was a surprise bestseller and award winner in the author's native Sweden. Jack said that eels are not a subject he would normally spend time reading about, but it came recommended by a patron, so he gave it a shot. And what he learned is that the eel, it turns out, is an elusive creature. For centuries, millennia actually, all the way back to Aristotle, scientists and great thinkers have attempted to solve what is called the, quote, the eel problem. Actually, the eel The eel question, sorry, that quote, eel question. Actually, the eel question is a bit of a misnomer, as there are numerous questions about this creature. Even today, in an age of advanced science, no one has ever seen eels mating or giving birth, and we still don't understand what drives them, after living for decades in freshwater, to swim great distances back to the ocean at the end of their lives. They remain a mystery.
Interesting.
Yes, the book alternates between chapters about the eel and its lifestyle and its mysteries, and chapters concerning the author's growing up years with his father in Sweden, where he and his dad fished for eels. So it's partially nature book and partially memoir, but it's all eel. To share one fascinating story highlighted in the book, there was a tale of a boy somewhere in Europe dropping an eel down a well sometime in the mid-19th century. The story circulated that this eel continued to live into the 20th century and even into the 21st century. In recent years, a news crew opened up the well and down below found an eel, possibly the eel, which would make the critter something like 150 or so years old. Apparently, there was indication that the eel was extremely old based on its size and its features. Jack said they should have left it alone. Talk about opening a can of worms. because the eel died shortly after that. He lived for 150 years down there.
Oh, heavens.
But yeah, this is one of those books where you don't think you need a book about eels, but it can really open you up to just the wonders and majesty of nature.
And that's what books,
that's what books should do.
Yeah.
That's right.
The title is...
That's called The Book of Eels, Our Enduring Fascination with the Most Mysterious Creature in the Natural World by Patrick Svensson.
Excellent. Okay. Ray.
Well, I just want to say I love when books zone in on one specific thing like that. And you can often get the most out of books like that.
Totally.
I love that. My next pick is called Sharks Don't Sink, Adventures of a Rogue Shark Scientist by Jasmine Graham. And Jasmine Graham is a black female shark scientist, which are hard to come by in the marine biology world. And she really had a challenging journey trying to navigate the traditional confines of academia. And so she actually went rogue. She decided to become an independent researcher she joined with three other black women to form Minorities in Shark Science, Minorities in Shark Sciences, known as MISS, which is an organization dedicated to providing support and opportunities for young women of color in marine biology. And she draws a lot of parallels to her life to sharks. And for example, sharks need to keep swimming to stay alive. And she realized that even though she was struggling in the traditional academic setting, she realized she had to keep moving forward and keep enduring. And she's really full of confidence, and it really shines through in her writing in this book. I love her style. It's informal and more like spoken language. It includes words that are you wouldn't really normally see in a nonfiction book about sharks, which is really cool, and it makes it really accessible. And I think it will be very inspiring to young women who are struggling with the community that they are trying to fit into, and seeing other women like them out there that are studying sharks. I just found it very inspiring.
Excellent. The book is, once again?
Sharks Don't Sink by Jasmine Graham.
Excellent. Before we get to Gabrielle, this is a good time to mention any books on nature on the Cape. We have to talk about books by Robert Finch, who is our own Cape Cod notebook writer. Bob has a number of books available. His writings, his observations on nature, on the Cape, on life. And both of you had mentioned that you have books by Robert Finch in your respective
Yes, we have several in our Cape Cod collection, and I know Ray has some.
Great. Yes, always.
So, Gabrielle, what do you have next?
Actually, I want to continue on with the theme that Ray was just talking about, because I found this great book called Soil, The Story of a Black Mother's Garden by Camille T. Dungy. This was just published in May, and it's a memoir of motherhood, gardening, and environmental justice. So Camille Dungy is a poet and professor who edited a 2009 poetry anthology called Black Nature, Four Centuries of African American Nature Poetry, which was the first anthology to bring African American environmental poetry to national attention. Because a lot of times when we're talking about the greats of nature writing, we're often talking about white, often male writers. So what Dungy does here is she shines a light in her anthology. She shines a light on the other voices that haven't been as elevated. So in this book, Soil, she recounts the 7-year odyssey to diversify her garden in the predominantly white community of Fort Collins, Colorado. When she moved there in 2013 with her husband and daughter, the community held restrictions about what residents could and could not plant in their gardens. In resistance to the homogeneous policies that limited the possibility and wonder that grows from the earth, Dungy employs the various plants, herbs, vegetables, and flowers she grows in her garden as metaphor for how homogeneity threatens the future of our planet, and why cultivating diverse and intersectional language in our national discourse about the environment is the best means of protecting it. So readers follow Dungy as she tackles the project of transforming what has been a conventional suburban lawn into a vibrant pollinator garden full of native plants. Throughout the book, she uses her poetic prose to paint evocative images of the flowers, plants, and animals that populate her yard. But this is about so much more than just her garden. Instead of the conventional nature narrative in which an individual, often white and well-off, communes with nature, Dungy offers a more complex, nuanced story in which the experience of nature is vital, but also entangled with race, national and family history, motherhood, and more. So I took a quote from the book that I thought illustrated well some of what it conveys. The green of growing things calms me. Plants stabilize me. And I am interested in the patience that is required as I wait for growth. For the politically engaged person, any of us, such patience is a key to survival. Patience is a kindness that carries me through long days and longer nights. And I just love that because I think in tending a garden or also in raising a child, you have to have a lot of patience. You put in work, but you have to have faith that these things will grow in a good way. And I love the way the book combines motherhood and gardening and environmental justice.
That's so great.
Yes, that's called Soil, The Story of a Black Mother's Garden by Camille T. Dungy.
Right.
My next book is Of Time and Turtles by Cy Montgomery. And you may know Cy Montgomery from The Soul of an Octopus, which was a National Book Award finalist. She's written many books on various animals. And we're just talking about how zoning in on one single animal can be really profound. And she definitely accomplished that with this book. She really focuses on the aspect of time and how they're slow moving, they're unhurried, they're ancient, they've been around since the dinosaurs. She uses that to explore the question of what do we do with our time and how can we make peace with time, especially on a threatened, endangered planet. And so she and the illustrator of the book, Matt Patterson, spend a year at the Turtle Rescue League, saving turtles. And, they really learn a lot about these amazing animals and also explore, humans I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
What's the title of the book? Is
it's called Of Time and Turtles by Cy Montgomery.
What a great title. What a great book.
Yes.
Excellent. Gabrielle.
Yes. So I've just am thinking about how in each of these books, the topic of climate change may not necessarily be front and center, but I found that each mentioned them in their own way, because it's sort of you can't ignore how much nature is changing in ways that it has never before. And I just wanted to mention, for anyone who's interested, the Barnstable Land Trust is doing a climate conversations series, which is bringing together people from our local community to talk about how climate change is showing up here, and to come up with exchange ideas and thoughts on what we can actually do in our community. So if you want, you can go to the Barnstable Land Trust website and check that out and see how you can get involved in the conversation.
I have a friend who attended one of those, and it was, I think it was about pollinators, and she loved it.
Yes, they do an excellent job. And we actually are working with them to bring one conversation at Sturgis, and a lot of different libraries and local organizations are too. So that's a way to take this local for people. But my next book is called The God of the Woods by Liz Moore. And this was just published this month. It's a literary suspense novel. It's 478 pages, but I read this in, I think, 2 days. Wow. I stayed up one night to 2 a.m. to finish it, so that the suspense is real. This is not something I would normally go for, because the plot centers on the disappearance of two children, and that's just a subject that I find too terrifying and heartbreaking to spend too much time with. But it came highly recommended from a patron, and I found the setting so alluring. It's set in the lush woods and lakes of the Adirondacks in the 1970s. So we see campers learning survival skills and enjoying good old-fashioned summer camp fun. So I'm just going to read the dust jacket to give you a sense of what it's about. Early morning, August 1975, a camp counselor discovers an empty bunk. Its occupant, Barbara Van Laar, has gone missing. Barbara isn't just any 13-year-old. She's the daughter of the family that owns the summer camp and employs most of the region's residents. And this isn't the first time a Van Laar child has disappeared. Barbara's older brother similarly vanished 14 years ago, never to be found. As a panicked search begins, a thrilling drama unfolds, chasing down the layered mysteries of the Van Laar family and the blue-collar community living and working in its shadow. Moore's multi-threaded story invites readers into a rich and gripping dynasty of secrets.
And that book, that sounds intriguing.
Yes, it's great. It's called The God of the Woods by Liz Moore.
Excellent. And Ray, you have one more book that we've got to get to.
Yes, yes. This one's called Millie Fleur's Poison Garden by Christy Mandan. And this book made me smile so much. It's about a girl named Millie Fleur who moves into a town where everyone's gardens are perfect, everyone's houses are perfect, everything is just the same and picture perfect. And she plants her own garden in her house and she has all these crazy weird plants, like the sneezing sticky weed and the grumpy gilliflower or gilliglower, and they all just have these really funny names and are really like
great
ugly but cute and
it's a
and
fun
poisonous
looking book.
Anyways, so everyone in the town hates her garden because it's ugly, but she invites her whole class to come, and they all love it.
And again, the book is called...
It's based on a real garden, too. It's called Millie Fleur's Poison Garden.
So many more books to talk about. Ray Titcomb from Titcomb's Bookshop in Sandwich and Gabrielle Faria-Kakalnis from Sturgis Library in Barnstable, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dan.
We will have a list of all the books we talked about on today's show later on at our website, CapeandIslands.org. We thank you so very much for listening. I'm Dan Tridle in for Mindy Todd. We'll talk to you later. Thanks.